That's not so, Joan said. I think it is, Gus Duer contradicted him. As always, the American was a bit diffident in his manner, but he made an effort to speak insistently. I spoke to some of the men coming up. They said the lockers marked breathing apparatus turned out to be empty. He seemed to be suppressing anger. Ethel Williams said, and they couldn't put out the flames because there was insufficient water kept underground. Her eyes flashed with fury in a way that Fitz found alluring, and his heart skipped a beat. There's a fire engine, Jones protested. Gus Duer spoke again, a cold dram filled with water and a hand pump. Ethel Williams went on, they should have been able to reverse the flow of ventilation, but Mr. Jones has not modified the machinery in accordance with the law. Jones looked indignant. It wasn't possible. Fitz interrupted. All right, Jones. This isn't a public inquiry. His Majesty just wants to get people's impressions. Quite so, said the King. But there is one subject on which you might be able to advise me, Jones. I should be honored. I was planning to visit Aberdeen and some of the surrounding villages tomorrow morning, and indeed to call upon your good self at the town hall. But in these circumstances a parade seems inappropriate. Sir Alan, sitting behind the King's left shoulder, shook his head and murmured, quite impossible. On the other hand, the King went on, it seems wrong to go away without any acknowledgement of the disaster. People might think us indifferent. Fitz guessed there was a clash between the King and his staff. They probably wanted to cancel the visit, imagining that this was the least risky course, whereas the King felt the need to make some gesture. There was a silence while Percival considered the question. When he spoke, he said only, it's a difficult choice. Ethel Williams said, may I make a suggestion? Peel was aghast. Williams, he hissed, speak only when spoken to. Fitz was startled by her impertinence in the presence of the King. He tried to keep his voice calm as he said, perhaps later, Williams. But the King smiled. To Fitz's relief, he seemed quite taken with Ethel. We might as well hear what this young person has to propose, he said. That was all Ethel needed. Without further ado, she said, you and the Queen should visit the bereaved families. No parade, just one carriage with black horses. It would mean a lot to them, and everybody would think you were wonderful. She bit her lip and subsided into silence. The last sentence was a breach of etiquette, Fitz thought anxiously. The King did not need to make people think he was wonderful. Sir Alan was horrified. Never been done before, he said in alarm. But the King seemed intrigued by the idea. Visit the bereaved, he said musingly. He turned to his equerry. By Jove, I think that's capital, Alan. Commiserate with my people in their suffering. No cavalcade, just one carriage. He turned back to the maid. Very good, Williams, he said. Thank you for speaking up. Fitz breathed a sigh of relief. 7. In the end there was more than one carriage, of course. The King and Queen went in the first with Sir Alan and a lady-in-waiting. Fitz and Bayer followed in a second with the Bishop, and a pony and trap with assorted servants brought up the rear. Percival Jones had wanted to be one of the party, but Fitz had squashed that idea. As Ethel had pointed out, the bereaved might have tried to take him by the throat. It was a windy day, and a cold rain lashed the horses as they trotted down the long drive of Tiguen. Ethel was in the third vehicle. Because of her father's job, she was familiar with every mining family in Aberdeen. She was the only person at Tiguen who knew the names of all the dead and injured. She had given directions to the drivers, and it would be her job to remind the equerry who was who. She had her fingers crossed. This was her idea, and if it went wrong, she would be blamed. As they drove out of the Grand Iron Gate, she was struck, as always, by the sudden transition. Inside the grounds, all was order, charm, and beauty. Outside was the ugliness of the real world. A row of agricultural labourers' cottages stood beside the road, tiny houses of two rooms, with odd bits of lumber and junk in front, and a couple of dirty children playing in the ditch. Soon afterward, the miners' terraces began. Superior to the farm cottages, but still ungainly and monotonous to an eye such as Ethel's, spoiled by the perfect proportions of Tiguen's windows and doorways and roofs. The people out here had cheap clothes that quickly became shapeless and worn, and were coloured with dyes that faded, so that all the men were in greyish suits and all the women brownish dresses. Ethel's maid's outfit was envied for its warm wool skirt and crisp cotton blouse, for all that some of the girls liked to say they would never lower themselves to be servants. But the biggest difference was in the people themselves. Out here they had blemished skin, dirty hair, and black fingernails. The men coughed, the women sniffed, and the children all had runny noses. The poor shambled and limped along roads where the rich strode confidently. The carriages drove down the mountainside to Mafeking Terrace. Most of the inhabitants were lining the pavements, waiting, but there were no flags, and they did not cheer, just bowed and curtsied as the cavalcade pulled up outside number 19. Ethel jumped down and spoke quietly to Sir Alan. Sean Evans, 5 children, lost her husband, David Evans, an underground horse wrangler. David Evans, known as Di Ponies, had been familiar to Ethel as an elder of the Bethesda Chapel. Sir Alan nodded, and Ethel stepped smartly back while he murmured in the ear of the king. Ethel caught Fitz's eye, and he gave her a nod of approval. She felt a glow. She was assisting the king, and the earl was pleased with her. The king and queen went to the front door. Its paint was peeling, but the step was polished. I never thought I'd see this, Ethel thought, the king knocking on the door of a collier's house. The king wore a tailcoat and a tall black hat. Ethel had strongly advised Sir Alan that the people of Aberowen would not wish to see their monarch in the kind of tweed suit that they themselves might wear. The door was opened by the widow in her Sunday best, complete with hat. Fitz had suggested that the king should surprise people, but Ethel had argued against that, and Sir Alan had agreed with her. On a surprise visit to a distraught family, the royal couple might have been confronted with drunken men, half-naked women, and fighting children. Better to forewarn everyone. "Good morning. I'm the king," said the king, raising his hat politely. "Are you Mrs. David Evans?" She looked blank for a moment. She was more used to being called Mrs. Di Ponies. "I have come to say how very sorry I am about your husband David," said the king. Mrs. Di Ponies seemed too nervous to feel any emotion. "Thank you very much," she said stiffly. It was too formal, Ethel saw. The king was as uncomfortable as the widow. Neither was able to say how they really felt. Then the queen touched Mrs. Di's arm. "It must be very hard for you, my dear," she said. "Yes, ma'am, it is," said the widow in a whisper, and then she burst into tears. Ethel wiped a tear from her own cheek. The king was embarrassed, but to his credit, he stood his ground, murmuring, "Very sad, very sad." Mrs. Evans sobbed uncontrollably, but she seemed rooted to the spot and did not turn her face away. There was nothing gracious about grief, Ethel saw. Mrs. Di's face was blotched red, her open mouth showed that she had lost half her teeth, and her sobs were hoarse with desperation. "There, there," said the queen. She pressed her handkerchief into Mrs. Di's hand. "Take this." Mrs. Di was not yet 30, but her big hands were knotted and lumpy with arthritis like an old woman's. She wiped her face with the queen's handkerchief. Her sobs subsided. "He was a good man, ma'am," she said. "Never raised a hand to me." The queen did not know what to say about a man whose virtue was that he did not beat his wife. "He was even kind to his ponies," Mrs. Di added. "I'm sure he was," said the queen, back on familiar ground. A toddler emerged from the depths of the house and clung to its mother's skirt. The king tried again. "I believe you have 5 children," he said. "Oh, sir, what are they going to do with no Da?" "It's very sad," the king repeated. Sir Alan coughed, and the king said, "We're going on to see some other people in the same sad position as yourself." "Oh, sir, it was kind of you to come. I can't tell you how much it means to me. Thank you, thank you." The king turned away. The queen said, "I will pray for you tonight, Mrs. Evans." Then she followed the king. As they were getting into the carriage, Fitz gave Mrs. Di an envelope. Inside, Ethel knew, were 5 gold sovereigns and a note, handwritten on blue-crested Tiguan paper, saying, "Earl Fitzherbert wishes you to have this token of his deep sympathy." That, too, had been Ethel's idea. Eight. 1 week after the explosion, Billy went to chapel with his Da, Mam, and Grandpa. The Bethesda chapel was a square whitewashed room with no pictures on the walls. The chairs were arranged in neat rows on four sides of a plain table. On the table stood a loaf of white bread on a Woolworth's china plate and a jug of cheap sherry, the symbolic bread and wine. The service was not called communion or mass, but simply the breaking of the bread. By 11 o'clock the congregation of 100 or so worshippers were in their seats, the men in their best suits, the women in hats, the children scrubbed and fidgeting in the back rows. There was no set ritual. The men would do as the Holy Spirit moved them, extemporize a prayer, announce a hymn, read a passage from the Bible, or give a short sermon. The women would remain silent, of course. In practice, there was a pattern. The first prayer was always spoken by one of the elders, who would then break the loaf and hand the plate to the nearest person. Each member of the congregation, excluding the children, would take a small piece and eat it. Next, the wine was passed around and everyone drank from the jug, the women taking tiny sips, some of the men enjoying a good mouthful. After that, they all sat in silence until someone was moved to speak. When Billy had asked his father at what age he should begin taking a vocal part in the service, Da had said, "There's no rule. We follow where the Holy Spirit leads." Billy had taken him at his word. If the first line of a hymn came into his mind, at some point during the hour, he took that as a nudge from the Holy Spirit, and he would stand up and announce the hymn. He was precocious in doing so at his age, he knew, but the congregation accepted that. The story of how Jesus had appeared to him during his underground initiation had been retold in half the chapels in the South Wales coalfield, and Billy was seen as special. This morning every prayer begged for consolation for the bereaved, especially Mrs. Di Ponies, who was sitting there in a veil, her eldest son beside her looking scared. Da asked God for the greatness of heart to forgive the wickedness of the mine owners in flouting laws about breathing equipment and reversible ventilation. Billy felt something was missing. It was too simple just to ask for healing. He wanted help in understanding how the explosion fitted into God's plan. He had never yet extemporized a prayer. Many of the men prayed with fine-sounding phrases and quotations from the scriptures, almost as if they were sermonizing. Billy himself suspected God was not so easily impressed. He always felt most moved by simple prayers that seemed heartfelt. Toward the end of the service, words and sentences began to take shape in his mind, and he felt a strong impulse to give voice to them. Taking that for the guidance of the Holy Spirit, he eventually stood up. With his eyes shut tight, he said, "O God, we have asked thee this morning to bring comfort to those who have lost a husband, a father, a son, especially our sister in the Lord, Mrs. Evans, and we pray that the bereaved will open their hearts to receive thy benison." This had been said by others. Billy paused, then went on, "And now, Lord, we ask for one more gift, the blessing of understanding. We need to know, Lord, why this explosion of tick and place down the pit. All things are in thy power, so why didst thou allow fire damp to fill the main level, and why didst thou permit it to catch alight? How come, Lord, that men are set over us, directors of Celtic Minerals, who in their greed for money become careless of the lives of thy people? How can the deaths of good men and the mangling of the bodies thou didst create serve thy holy purpose?" He paused again. He knew it was wrong to make demands of God, as if negotiating with the management. So he added, "We know that the suffering of the people of Aberowyn must play a part in thy eternal plan." He thought he should probably leave it there, but he could not refrain from adding, "But Lord, we can't see how, so please explain it to us." He finished, "In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ." The congregation said, "Amen." 9. That afternoon the people of Aberowyn were invited to view the gardens at Tŷ Gwen. It meant a lot of work for Ethel. A notice had gone up in the pubs on Saturday night, and the message was read in churches and chapels after services on Sunday morning. The gardens had been made especially lovely for the king, despite the winter season, and now Earl Fitzherbert wished to share their beauty with his neighbours, the invitation said. The Earl would be wearing a black tie, and he would be glad to see his visitors wearing a similar token of respect for the dead, although it would obviously be inappropriate to have a party. Nevertheless, refreshments would be offered. Ethel had ordered three marquees to be pitched on the east lawn. In one were half a dozen 108-gallon butts of pale ale, brought by train from the Crown Brewery and Pontyclun. For teetotalers, of whom there were many in Aberowen, the next tent had trestle tables bearing giant tea urns and hundreds of cups and saucers. In the third, smaller tent, sherry was offered to the town's diminutive middle class, including the Anglican vicar, both doctors, and the colliery manager, Maldwyn Morgan, who was already being referred to as Gone to Merthyr Morgan. By good luck, it was a sunny day, cold but dry, with a few harmless-looking white clouds high in a blue sky. 4,000 people came, very nearly the entire population of the town, and almost everyone wore a black tie, ribbon, or armband. They strolled around the shrubbery, peered through the windows into the house, and churned up the lawns. Princess Bear stayed in her room. This was not her kind of social event. All upper-class people were selfish, in Ethel's experience, but Bear had made an art of it. All her energy was focused on pleasing herself and getting her own way. Even when giving a party, something she did well, her motive was mainly to provide a showcase for her own beauty and charm. Fitz held court in the Victorian Gothic splendour of the Great Hall, with his huge dog lying on the floor beside him like a fur rug. He wore the brown tweed suit that made him seem more approachable, albeit with a stiff collar and black tie. He looked handsomer than ever, Ethel thought. She brought the relatives of the dead and injured to see him in groups of three or four, so that he was able to commiserate with every Aberowen resident who had suffered. He spoke to them with his usual charm, and sent each one away feeling special. Ethel was now the housekeeper. After the king's visit, Princess Bea had insisted that Mrs. Jevons retire permanently. She had no time for tired old servants. In Ethel, she had seen someone who would work hard to fulfill her wishes, and had promoted her despite her youth. So Ethel had achieved her ambition. She had taken over the housekeeper's little room off the servants' hall, and had hung up a photograph of her parents in their Sunday best, taken outside the Bethesda Chapel the day it had opened. When Fitz came to the end of the list, Ethel asked permission to spend a few minutes with her family. "Of course," said the Earl. "Take as much time as you like. You've been absolutely marvellous. I don't know how I would have managed without you. The King was grateful for your help, too. How do you remember all those names?" She smiled. She was not sure why it gave her such a thrill to be praised by him. "Most of these people have been to our house, some time or other, to see my father about compensation for an injury, or a dispute with an overseer, or a worry about some safety measure down the pit. Well, I think you're remarkable," he said, and gave the irresistible smile that occasionally came over his face and made him seem almost like the boy next door. "Give my respects to your father." She went out and ran across the lawn, feeling on top of the world. She found Da, Mam, Billy, and Grandpa in the tea tent. Da looked distinguished in his black Sunday suit and a white shirt with a stiff collar. Billy had a nasty burn on his cheek. Ethel said, "How are you feeling, Billy boy?" "Not bad. It looks horrible, but the doctor says it's better without a bandage. Everybody's talking about how brave you were. It wasn't enough to save Mickey Pope, though." There was nothing to say to that, but Ethel touched her brother's arm in sympathy. Mam said proudly, "Billy led us in prayer this morning at Bethesda. Well done, Billy. I'm sorry I missed it." Ethel had not gone to chapel. There was too much to do in the house. "What did you pray about?" "I asked the Lord to help us understand why he allowed the explosion down the pit." Billy cast a nervous glance at Da, who was not smiling. Da said severely, "Billy might have done better to ask God to strengthen his faith so that he can believe without understanding." Clearly they had already argued about this. Ethel did not have the patience for theological disputes that made no difference to anything in the end. She tried to brighten the mood. "Earl Fitzherbert asked me to give you his respects, Da," she said. "Wasn't that nice of him?" Da did not melt. "I was sorry to see you taking part in that farce on Monday," he said sternly. "Monday?" she said incredulously. "When the king visited the families. I saw you whispering the names to that flunky. That was Sir Alan Tite. I don't care what he calls himself. I know a lickspittle when I see one." Ethel was shocked. How could Da be scornful of her great moment? She felt like crying. "I thought you'd be proud of me, helping the king. How dare the king offer sympathy to our folk? What does a king know of hardship and danger?" Ethel fought back tears. "But Da, It meant so much to people that he went to see them. It distracted everyone's attention from the dangerous and illegal actions of Celtic Minerals. But they need comfort. Why could he not see this? The king softened them up. Last Sunday afternoon, this town was ready to revolt. By Monday evening, all they could talk about was the queen giving her handkerchief to Mrs. Dieponies. Ethel went swiftly from heartbreak to anger. "I'm sorry you feel that way," she said coldly. "Nothing to be sorry for. I'm sorry because you are wrong," she said, firmly overriding him. Dar was taken aback. It was rare for him to be told he was wrong by anyone, let alone a girl. Mam said, "Now, Eth, people have feelings, Dar," she said recklessly. "That's what you always forget." Dar was speechless. Mam said, "That's enough now." Ethel looked at Billy. Through a mist of tears, she saw his expression of awestruck admiration. That encouraged her. She sniffed and wiped her eyes with the back of her hand and said, "You and your union, and your safety regulations, and your scriptures. I know they're important, Dar, but you can't do away with people's feelings. I hope that one day socialism will make the world a better place for working people, but in the meantime they need consolation." Dar found his voice at last. "I think we've heard enough from you," he said. "Being with the king has gone to your head. You're a slip of a girl, and you've no business lecturing your elders." She was crying too much to argue further. "I'm sorry, Dar," she said. After a heavy silence, she added, "I'd better get back to work." The Earl had told her to take all the time she liked, but she wanted to be alone. She turned away from her father's glare and walked back to the big house. She kept her eyes downcast, hoping the crowds would not notice her tears. She did not want to meet anyone, so she slipped into the gardenia suite. Lady Maud had returned to London, so the room was empty and the bed was stripped. Ethel threw herself down on the mattress and cried. She had been feeling so proud. How could Dar undermine everything she had done? Did he want her to do a bad job? She worked for the nobility. So did every coal miner in Aberowen. Even though Celtic Minerals employed them, it was the Earl's coal they were digging. And he was paid the same per ton as the miner who dug it out of the earth, a fact her father never tired of pointing out. If it was all right to be a good collier, efficient and productive, what was wrong with being a good housekeeper? She heard the door open. Quickly she jumped to her feet. It was the Earl. "What on earth is the matter?" he said kindly. "I heard you from outside the door. I'm very sorry, my lord. I shouldn't have come in here." "That's all right." There was genuine concern on his impossibly handsome face. "Why are you crying?" "I was so proud to have helped the king," she said woefully, "but my father says it was a farce, all done just to stop people feeling angry with Celtic Minerals." She burst into fresh tears. "What nonsense," he said. "Anyone could tell that the king's concern was genuine, and the queen's." He took the white linen handkerchief from the breast pocket of his jacket. She expected him to hand it to her. But instead he wiped the tears from her cheeks with a gentle touch. "I was proud of you last Monday, even if your father wasn't." "You're so kind." "There, there," he said, and he bent down and kissed her lips. She was dumbfounded. It was the last thing in the world she had expected. When he straightened up, she stared at him uncomprehendingly. He gazed back at her. "You are absolutely enchanting," he said in a low voice. Then he kissed her again. This time she pushed him away. "My lord, what are you doing?" she said in a shocked whisper. "I don't know." "But what can you be thinking of?" "I'm not thinking at all." She stared up at his chiseled face. The green eyes studied her intently, as if trying to read her mind. She realized that she adored him. Suddenly she was flooded with excitement and desire. "I can't help myself," he said. She sighed happily. "Kiss me again, then," she said. Chapter 3. February 1914. At 10:30, the looking-glass in the hall of Earl Fitzherbert's Mayfair house showed a tall man, immaculately dressed in the daytime clothing of an upper-class Englishman. He wore an upright collar, disliking the fashion for soft collars, and his silver tie was fastened with a pearl. Some of his friends thought it was undignified to dress well. "I say, Fitz, you look like a damn tailor about to open his shop in the morning," the young Marquis of Lowther had said to him once. But Lowther was a scruff, with crumbs on his waistcoat and cigar ash on the cuffs of his shirt, and he wanted everyone else to look as bad. Fitz hated to be grubby. It suited him to be spruce. He put on a grey top hat. With his walking stick in his right hand and a new pair of grey suede gloves in his left, he went out of the house and turned south. In Berkeley Square, a blonde girl of about 14 winked at him and said, "Sack you for a shilling." He crossed Piccadilly and entered Green Park. A few snowdrops clustered around the roots of the trees. He passed Buckingham Palace and entered an unattractive neighbourhood near Victoria Station. He had to ask a policeman for directions to Ashley Gardens. The street turned out to be behind the Roman Catholic Cathedral. Really, Fitz thought, if one is going to ask members of the nobility to call, one should have one's office in a respectable quarter. He had been summoned by an old friend of his father's named Mansfield Smith Cumming. A retired naval officer, Smith Cumming was now doing something vague in the War Office. He had sent Fitz a rather short note. "I should be grateful for a word on a matter of national importance. Can you call on me tomorrow morning at, say, 11 o'clock? The note was typewritten and signed in green ink with the single letter C. In truth, Fitz was pleased that someone in the government wanted to talk to him. He had a horror of being thought of as an ornament, a wealthy aristocrat with no function other than to decorate social events. He hoped he was going to be asked for his advice, perhaps about his old regiment, the Welsh Rifles. Or there might be some task he could perform in connection with the South Wales Territorials, of which he was honorary colonel. Anyway, just being summoned to the War Office made him feel he was not completely superfluous. If this really was the War Office, the address turned out to be a modern block of apartments. A doorman directed Fitz to an elevator. Smith Cumming's flat seemed to be part home, part office, but a briskly efficient young man with a military air told Fitz that C would see him right away. C did not have a military air. Podgy and balding, he had a nose like Mr. Punch and wore a monocle. His office was cluttered with miscellaneous objects, model aircraft, a telescope, a compass, and a painting of peasants facing a firing squad. Fitz's father had always referred to Smith Cumming as the seasick sea captain, and his naval career had not been brilliant. What was he doing here? "What exactly is this department?" Fitz asked as he sat down. "This is the foreign section of the Secret Service Bureau," said C. "I didn't know we had a Secret Service Bureau. If people knew, it wouldn't be secret." "I see." Fitz felt a twinge of excitement. It was flattering to be given confidential information. "Perhaps you'd be kind enough not to mention it to anyone." Fitz was being given an order, albeit politely phrased. "Of course," he said. He was pleased to feel a member of an inner circle. Did this mean that C might ask him to work for the War Office? "Congratulations on the success of your royal house party. I believe you put together an impressive group of well-connected young men for His Majesty to meet."
"Thank you. It was a quiet social occasion, strictly speaking, but I'm afraid word gets around."
"And now you're taking your wife to Russia."
"The princess is Russian. She wants to visit her brother. It's a long postponed trip."
"And Gus Dua is going with you."
C seemed to know everything. "He's on a world tour," Fitz said. "Our plans coincided."
C sat back in his chair and said conversationally, "Do you know why Admiral Alexeyev was put in charge of the Russian army in the war against Japan, even though he knew nothing about fighting on land?"
Having spent time in Russia as a boy, Fitz had followed the progress of the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 to 1905, but he did not know this story.
"Tell me." "Well, it seems the Grand Duke Alexis was involved in a punch-up in a brothel in Marseille and got arrested by the French police. Alexeyev came to the rescue and told the gendarmes that it was he, not the Grand Duke, who had misbehaved. The similarity of their names made the story plausible, and the Grand Duke was let out of jail. Alexeyev's reward was command of the army."
"No wonder they lost."
"All the same, the Russians deployed the largest army the world has ever known. 6 million men, by some calculations, assuming they call up all their reserves. No matter how incompetent their leadership, it's a formidable force. But how effective would they be in, say, a European war?"
"I haven't been back since my marriage," Fitz said. "I'm not sure."
"Nor are we. That's where you come in. I would like you to make some inquiries while you're there."
Fitz was surprised.
"But surely our embassy should do that." "Of course." C shrugged. "But diplomats are always more interested in politics than military matters."
"Still, There must be a military attaché. An outsider such as yourself can offer a fresh perspective, in much the same way as your group at Ti Gwen gave the king something he could not have got from the Foreign Office. But if you feel you can't, I'm not refusing, Fitz said hastily. On the contrary, he was pleased to be asked to do a job for his country. I'm just surprised that things should be done this way. We are a newish department with few resources. My best informants are intelligent travellers with enough military background to understand what they're looking at. Very well. I'd be interested to know whether you felt the Russian officer class has moved on since 1905. Have they modernized, or are they still attached to old ideas? You'll meet all the top men in St. Petersburg. Your wife is related to half of them. Fitz was thinking about the last time Russia went to war. The main reason they lost against Japan was that the Russian railways were inadequate to supply their army. But since then they have been trying to improve their rail network, using money borrowed from France, their ally. Have they made much progress, I wonder? That's the key question. You'll be travelling by rail. Do the trains run on time? Keep your eyes open. Are the lines still mostly single track or double? The German generals have a contingency plan for war that is based on a calculation of how long it will take to mobilize the Russian army. If there is a war, much will hang on the accuracy of that timetable. Fitz was as excited as a schoolboy, but he forced himself to speak with gravity. I'll find out all I can. Thank you. C looked at his watch. Fitz stood up and they shook hands. When are you going, exactly? C asked. We leave tomorrow, said Fitz. Goodbye. 2. Grigory Peshkov watched his younger brother, Lev, taking money off the tall American. Lev's attractive face wore an expression of boyish eagerness, as if his main aim was to show off his skill. Grigory suffered a familiar pang of anxiety. One day, he feared, Lev's charm would not be enough to keep him out of trouble. "This is a memory test," Lev said in English. He had learned the words by rote. "Take any card." He had to raise his voice over the racket of the factory. Heavy machinery, clanking, steam hissing, people yelling instructions and questions. The visitor's name was Gus Duer. He wore a jacket, waistcoat, and trousers all in the same fine grey woolen cloth. Grigory was especially interested in him because he came from Buffalo. Duer was an amiable young man. With a shrug, he took a card from Lev's pack and looked at it. Lev said, "Put it on the bench, face down." Duer put the card on the rough wooden workbench. Lev took a ruble note from his pocket and placed it on the card. "Now you put a dollar down." This could be done only with rich visitors. Grigory knew that Lev had already switched the playing card. In his hand, concealed by the ruble note, there had been a different card. The skill, which Lev had practiced for hours, lay in picking up the first card and concealing it in the palm of the hand, immediately after putting down the ruble note and the new card.
"Are you sure you can afford to lose a dollar, Mr. Duer?" said Lev.
Duer smiled, as the marks always did at that point. "I think so," he said.
"Do you remember your card?"
Lev did not really speak English. He could say these phrases in German, French, and Italian, too.
"Five of spades," said Duer.
"Wrong." "I'm pretty sure."
"Turn it over."
Duer turned over the card. It was the Queen of Clubs. Lev scooped up the dollar bill and his original ruble. Grigory held his breath. This was the dangerous moment. Would the American complain that he had been robbed and accuse Lev? Duer grinned ruefully and said, "You got me."
"I know another game," Lev said.
It was enough. Lev was about to push his luck. Although he was 20 years old, Grigory still had to protect him.
"Don't play against my brother," Grigory said to Duer in Russian. "He always wins."
Duer smiled and replied hesitantly in the same tongue. "That's good advice." Duer was the first of a small group of visitors touring the Putilov Machine Works. It was the largest factory in St. Petersburg, employing 30,000 men, women, and children. Grigory's job was to show them his own small but important section. The factory made locomotives and other large steel artifacts. Grigory was foreman of the shop that made train wheels. Grigory was itching to speak to Duer about Buffalo. But before he could ask a question, the supervisor of the casting section, Kanin, appeared. A qualified engineer, he was tall and thin with receding hair. With him was a second visitor. Grigori knew from his clothes that this must be the British lord. He was dressed like a Russian nobleman, in a tailcoat and a top hat. Perhaps this was the clothing worn by the ruling class all over the world. The lord's name, Grigori had been told, was Earl Fitzherbert. He was the handsomest man Grigori had ever seen, with black hair and intense green eyes. The women in the wheel shop stared as if at a god. Kanin spoke to Fitzherbert in Russian. "We are now producing two new locomotives every week here," he said proudly. "Amazing," said the English lord. Grigori understood why these foreigners were so interested. He read the newspapers, and he went to lectures and discussion groups organized by the St. Petersburg Bolshevik Committee. The locomotives made here were essential to Russia's ability to defend itself. The visitors might pretend to be idly curious, but they were collecting military intelligence. Kanin introduced Grigori. "Peshkov here is the factory's chess champion." Kanin was management, but he was all right. Fitzherbert was charming. He spoke to Varya, a woman of about 50 with her grey hair in a headscarf. "Very kind of you to show us your workplace," he said, cheerfully speaking fluent Russian with a heavy accent. Varya, a formidable figure, muscular and big-bosomed, giggled like a schoolgirl. The demonstration was ready. Grigori had placed steel ingots in the hopper and fired up the furnace, and the metal was now molten. But there was one more visitor to come, the Earl's wife, who was said to be Russian, hence his knowledge of the language, which was unusual in a foreigner. Grigori wanted to question Dürer about Buffalo, but before he had a chance, the Earl's wife came into the wheel shop. Her floor-length skirt was like a broom, pushing a line of dirt and swarf in front of her. She wore a short coat over her dress, and she was followed by a manservant carrying a fur cloak, a maid with a bag, and one of the directors of the factory, Count Maklakov, a young man dressed like Fitzherbert. Maklakov was obviously very taken with his guest, smiling and talking in a low voice, and taking her arm unnecessarily. She was extraordinarily pretty, with fair curls and a coquettish tilt to her head. Grigori recognized her immediately. She was Princess Bea. His heart lurched, and he felt nauseated. He fiercely repressed the ugly memory that rose out of the distant past. Then, as in any emergency, he checked on his brother. Would Lev remember? He had been only 6 years old at the time. Lev was looking with curiosity at the princess, as if trying to place her. Then, as Grigori watched, Lev's face changed, and he remembered. He went pale and looked ill. Then suddenly he reddened with anger. By that time, Grigori was at Lev's side. "Stay calm," he murmured. "Don't say anything. Remember, we're going to America. Nothing must interfere with that." Lev made a disgusted noise. "Go back to the stables," Grigori said. Lev was a pony driver, working with the many horses used in the factory. Lev glared a moment longer at the oblivious princess. Then he turned and walked away, and the moment of danger passed. Grigori began the demonstration. He nodded to Isaac, a man of his own age, who was captain of the factory football team. Isaac opened up the mold. Then he and Varya picked up a polished wooden template of a flanged train wheel. This in itself was a work of great skill, with spokes that were elliptical in cross-section and tapered by 1 in 20 from hub to rim. The wheel was for a big 464 locomotive, and the template was almost as tall as the people lifting it. They pressed it into a deep tray filled with damp, sandy molding mixture. Isaac swung the cast-iron chill on top of that to form the tread and the flange, and then finally the top of the mold. They opened up the assemblage, and Grigori inspected the hole made by the template. There were no visible irregularities. He sprayed the molding sand with a black, oily liquid. Then they closed the flask again. "Please stand well back now," he said to the visitors. Isaac moved the spout of the hopper to the funnel on top of the mold. Then Grigori pulled the lever that tilted the hopper. Molten steel poured slowly into the mold. Steam from the wet sand hissed out of vents. Grigori knew by experience when to raise the hopper and stop the flow. "The next step is to perfect the shape of the wheel," he said. "Because the hot metal takes so long to cool, I have here a wheel that was cast earlier." It was already set up on a lathe, and Grigori nodded to Konstantin, the lathe operator, who was Varya's son. A thin, gangling intellectual with wild black hair, Konstantin was chairman of the Bolshevik discussion group and Grigori's closest friend. He started the electric motor, turning the wheel at high speed, and began to shape it with a file.
"Please keep well away from the lathe," Grigori said to the visitors, raising his voice over the whine of the machine. "If you touch it, you may lose a finger."
He held up his left hand,
as I did here in this factory at the age of 12.
His third finger, the ring finger, was an ugly stump. He caught a glance of irritation from Count Maklakov, who did not enjoy being reminded of the human cost of his profits. The look he got from Princess Bea mingled disgust with fascination, and he wondered whether she was weirdly interested in squalor and suffering. It was unusual for a lady to tour a factory. He made a sign to Konstantin, who stopped the lathe.
"Next, the dimensions of the wheel are checked with calipers."
He held up the tool used.
"Train wheels must be exactly sized. If the diameter varies by more than 1/16 of an inch, which is about the width of the lead in a pencil, the wheel must be melted down and remade."
Fitzherbert said in broken Russian,
"How many wheels can you make per day?"
6 or 7 on average, allowing for rejects."
The American, Duar, asked, "What hours do you work?"
6 in the morning until 7 in the evening, Monday through Saturday. On Sunday we are allowed to go to church."
A boy of about 8 came racing into the wheel shop, pursued by a shouting woman, presumably his mother. Grigori made a grab for him to keep him away from the furnace. The boy dodged and cannoned into Princess Bea, his close-cropped head striking her in the ribs with an audible thump. She gasped, hurt. The boy stopped, apparently dazed. Furious, the princess drew back her arm and slapped his face so hard that he rocked on his feet, and Grigori thought he was going to fall over. The American said something abrupt in English, sounding surprised and indignant. In the next instant, the mother swept the boy up in her arms and turned away. Kanin, the supervisor, looked scared, knowing he might be blamed. He said to the princess,
"Most High Excellency, are you hurt?"
Princess Bea was visibly enraged, but she took a deep breath and said,
"It's nothing."
Her husband and the count went to her, looking concerned. Only Dürer stood back, his face a mask of disapproval and revulsion. He had been shocked by the slap, Grigori guessed, and he wondered whether all Americans were equally soft-hearted. A slap was nothing. Grigori and his brother had been flogged with canes as children in this factory. The visitors began to move away. Grigori was afraid he might lose his chance of questioning the tourist from Buffalo. Boldly, he touched Dürer's sleeve. A Russian nobleman would have reacted with indignation and shoved him away or struck him for insolence, but the American merely turned to him with a polite smile.
"You are from Buffalo, New York, sir?" said Grigori.
"That's right.
My brother and I are saving to go to America. We will live in Buffalo."
"Why that city?"
"Here in St. Petersburg is a family who get the necessary papers, for a fee, of course, and promise us jobs with their relatives in Buffalo."
"Who are these people?"
"Vyalov is the name."
The Vyalovs were a criminal gang, though they had lawful businesses too. They were not the most trustworthy people in the world, so Grigori wanted their claims independently verified.
"Sir, is the Vyalov family of Buffalo, New York, really an important rich family?"
"Yes," said Dürer. "Joseph Vyalov employs several hundred people in his hotels and bars."
"Thank you."
Grigori was relieved.
"That is very good to know."
3. Grigori's earliest memory was of the day the Tsar came to Bulovnir. He was 6. The people of the village had talked of little else for days. Everyone got up at dawn, even though it was obvious the Tsar would have his breakfast before setting out, so he could not possibly get there before mid-morning. Grigori's father carried the table out of their one-room dwelling and set it beside the road. On it, he placed a loaf of bread, a bunch of flowers, and a small container of salt, explaining to his elder son that these were the traditional Russian symbols of welcome. Most of the other villagers did the same. Grigori's grandmother had put on a new yellow headscarf. It was a dry day in early autumn, before the onset of the hard winter cold. The peasants sat on their haunches to wait. The village elders walked up and down in their best clothes, looking important, but they were waiting, just like everyone else. Grigori soon got bored and started to play in the dirt beside the house. His brother Lev was only a year old, and still being nursed by their mother. Noon passed, but no one wanted to go indoors and make dinner for fear they might miss the Tsar. Grigori tried to eat some of the loaf on the table and got his head smacked, but his mother brought him a bowl of cold porridge. Grigori was not sure who or what the Tsar was. He was frequently mentioned in church as loving all the peasants and watching over them while they slept, so he was clearly on a level with St. Peter and Jesus and the angel Gabriel. Grigori wondered if he would have wings or a crown of thorns, or just an embroidered coat like a village elder. Anyway, it was obvious that people were blessed just by seeing him, like the crowds that followed Jesus. It was late afternoon when a cloud of dust appeared in the distance. Grigori could feel vibrations in the ground beneath his felt boots, and soon he heard the drumming of hooves. The villagers got down on their knees. Grigori knelt beside his grandmother. The elders lay face down in the road with their foreheads in the dirt, as they did when Prince Andrei and Princess Bea came. Outriders appeared, followed by a closed carriage drawn by four horses. The horses were huge, the biggest Grigori had ever seen, and they were being driven at speed, their flanks shining with sweat, their mouths foaming around their bits. The elders realized they were not going to stop and scrambled out of the way before they were trampled. Grigori screamed in fear, but his cry was inaudible. As the carriage passed, his father shouted, "Long live the Tsar, father of his people!" By the time he finished, the carriage was already leaving the village behind. Grigori had not been able to see the passengers because of the dust. He realized he had missed seeing the Tsar, and therefore would receive no blessing, and he burst into tears. His mother took the loaf from the table, broke off an end, and gave it to him to eat, and he felt better. 4. When the shift at the Putilov machine works finished at 7 o'clock, Lev usually went off to play cards with his pals or drink with his easygoing girlfriends. Grigori often went to a meeting of some kind, a lecture on atheism, a socialist discussion group, a magic lantern show about foreign lands, a poetry reading. But tonight he had nothing to do. He would go home, make a stew for supper, leave some in the pot for Lev to eat later, and go to bed early. The factory was on the southern outskirts of St. Petersburg, its sprawl of chimneys and sheds covering a large site on the shore of the Baltic Sea. Many of the workers lived at the factory, some in barracks and some lying down to sleep beside their machines. That was why there were so many children running around. Grigori was among those who had a home outside the factory. In a socialist society, he knew, houses for workers would be planned at the same time as factories, but haphazard Russian capitalism left thousands of people with nowhere to live. Grigori was well paid, but he lived in a single room half an hour's walk from the factory. In Buffalo, he knew, factory hands had electricity and running water in their homes. He had been told that some had their own telephones, but that seemed ridiculous, like saying the streets were paved with gold. Seeing Princess Bea had taken him back to his childhood. As he wound his way through the icy streets, he refused to allow himself to dwell on the unbearable memory she brought to mind. All the same, he thought about the wooden hut where he had lived then, and he saw again the holy corner where the icons were hung, and opposite the sleeping corner where he lay down at night, usually with a goat or calf beside him. What he remembered most distinctly was something he had hardly noticed at the time, the smell. It came from the stove, the animals, the black smoke of the kerosene lamp, and the homemade tobacco his father smoked, rolled into newspaper cigarettes. The windows were shut tight with rags stuffed around the frames to keep the cold out, so the atmosphere was dense. He could smell it now in his imagination, and it made him nostalgic for the days before the nightmare, the last time in his life when he had felt secure. Not far from the factory, he came upon a sight that made him stop. In the pool of light thrown by a street lamp, two policemen, in black uniforms with green facings, were questioning a young woman. Her homespun coat and the way she tied the headscarf with a knot at the back of the neck suggested a peasant newly arrived in the city. At first glance, he took her to be about 16, the age he had been when he and Lev were orphaned. The stocky policeman said something and patted the girl's face. She flinched, and the other cop laughed.
Grigori remembered being ill-treated by everyone in authority as a 16-year-old orphan, and his heart went out to this vulnerable girl. Against his better judgment, he approached the little group. Just to have something to say, he said, "If you're looking for the Putilov works, I can show you the way."
The stocky policeman laughed and said, "Get rid of him, Ilya."
His sidekick had a small head and a mean face. "Get lost, scum," he said. Grigori was not afraid. He was tall and strong, his muscles hardened by constant heavy work. He had been in street fights ever since he was a boy, and he had not lost one for many years. Lev was the same. Nevertheless, it was better not to annoy the police. "I'm a foreman at the works," he said to the girl. "If you're looking for a job, I can help you." The girl shot him a grateful look.
"A foreman is nothing," said the stocky cop.
As he spoke, he looked directly at Grigori for the first time. In the yellow light from the kerosene street lamp, Grigori now recognized the round face with the look of stupid belligerence. The man was Mikhail Pinsky, the local precinct captain. Grigori's heart sank. It was madness to pick a fight with the precinct captain, but he had gone too far now to turn back. The girl spoke, and her voice told Grigori that she was nearer to 20 than 16.
"Thank you. I'll go with you, sir," she said to Grigori.
She was pretty, he saw, with delicately molded features and a wide, sensual mouth. Grigori looked around. Unfortunately, there was no one else about. He had left the factory a few minutes after the 7 o'clock rush. He knew he should back down, but he could not abandon this girl.
"I'll take you to the factory office," he said, though in fact it was now closed.
"She's coming with me, aren't you, Katerina?"
Pinsky said, and he pawed her, squeezing her breasts through the thin coat and thrusting a hand between her legs. She jumped back a pace and said, "Keep your filthy hands off!" With surprising speed and accuracy, Pinsky punched her in the mouth. She cried out, and blood spurted from her lips. Grigori was angered. Throwing caution to the wind, he stepped forward, put a hand to Pinsky's shoulder, and shoved hard. Pinsky staggered sideways and fell to one knee. Grigori turned to Katerina, who was crying.
"Run like hell," he said.
Then he felt an agonizing blow to the back of his head. The second policeman, Ilya, had deployed his nightstick faster than Grigori expected. The pain was excruciating, and he fell to his knees, but he did not black out. Katerina turned and ran, but she did not get far. Pinsky reached out and grabbed her foot, and she fell full length. Grigori turned and saw the nightstick coming at him again. He dodged the blow and scrambled to his feet. Ilya swung and missed again. Grigori aimed a blow at the side of the man's head and punched with all his force. Ilya fell to the ground. Grigori turned to see Pinsky standing over Katerina, kicking her repeatedly with his heavy boots. A motor car approached from the direction of the factory. As it passed, its driver braked hard, and it squealed to a stop under the street lamp. Two long strides brought Grigori to a position just behind Pinsky. He put both arms around the police captain, gripped him in a bear hug, and lifted him off the ground. Pinsky kicked his legs and waved his arms to no avail. The car door opened, and to Grigori's surprise, the American from Buffalo got out.
"What is happening?" he said.
His youthful face, lit by the streetlight, showed outrage as he addressed the wriggling Pinsky.
"Why do you kick a helpless woman?"
This was great good luck, Grigori thought. Only foreigners would object to a policeman kicking a peasant. The long, thin figure of Kanin, the supervisor, unfolded out of the car behind Dua.
"Let the policeman go, Peshkov," he said to Grigori.
Grigori set Pinsky on the ground and released him. He spun around, and Grigori got ready to dodge a blow, but Pinsky restrained himself. In a voice full of poison, he said,
"I'll remember you, Peshkov."
Grigori groaned. The man knew his name. Katerina got to her knees, moaning. Dua gallantly helped her to her feet, saying, "Are you badly hurt, miss?" Kanin looked embarrassed. No Russian would address a peasant so courteously. Ilya got up, looking dazed. He had a small head and a mean face. From within the car came the voice of Princess Bea, speaking English, sounding annoyed and impatient. Grigori addressed Dua.
"With your permission, Excellency, I will take this woman to a nearby doctor."
Dua looked at Katerina.
"Is that your wish?"
"Yes, sir,"
she said through bloody lips.
"Very well," he said.
Grigori took her arm and led her away before anyone could suggest otherwise. At the corner he glanced back. The two cops stood arguing with Duer and Kanin under the street lamp. Still holding Katerina's arm, he hurried her along, even though she was limping. They needed to put distance between themselves and Pinsky. As soon as they had turned the corner, she said, "I have no money for a doctor." "I could give you a loan," he said, with a pang of guilt. His money was for passage to America, not to soothe the bruises of pretty girls. She gave him a calculating look. "I don't really want a doctor," she said. "What I need is a job. Could you take me to the factory office?" She had guts, he thought admiringly. She had just been beaten up by a policeman, and all she could think about was getting a job. "The office is closed. I just said that to confuse the cops, but I can take you there in the morning. I have nowhere to sleep." She gave him a guarded look that he did not quite understand. Was she offering herself? Many peasant girls who came to the city ended up doing that. But perhaps her look meant the opposite, that she wanted a bed but was not prepared to pay with sexual favors. "In the house where I live there's a room shared by a number of women," he said. "They sleep three or more to a bed, and they can always find space for another one." "How far is it?" He pointed ahead to a street that ran alongside a railway embankment. "Just here." She nodded assent, and a few moments later they entered the house. He had a back room on the first floor. The narrow bed that he shared with Lev stood against one wall. There was a fireplace with a hob, and a table and two chairs next to the window that overlooked the railway. An upended packing case served as a nightstand, with a jug and bowl for washing. Katerina inspected the place with a long look that took everything in. Then she said, "You have all this to yourself?" "No, I'm not rich. I share with my brother. He'll be here later." She looked thoughtful. Perhaps she was afraid she might be expected to have sex with both of them. To reassure her, Grigori said, "Shall I introduce you to the women in the house?" "Plenty of time for that." She sat in one of the two chairs. "Let me rest a while." "Of course." The fire was laid, ready to be lit. He always built it in the morning before going to work. He put a match to the kindling. There was a thunderous noise, and Katerina looked frightened. "It's just a train," Grigori said. "We're right next to the railway." He poured water from the jug into the bowl, then set the bowl on the hob to warm. He sat opposite Katerina and looked at her. She had straight, fair hair and pale skin. At first he had judged her to be quite pretty. But now he saw that she was really beautiful, with an oriental cast to her bone structure that suggested Siberian ancestry. There was strength of character in her face, too. Her wide mouth was sexy, but also determined, and there seemed to be iron purpose in her blue-green eyes. Her lips were swelling up from Pinsky's punch. "How do you feel?" Grigori asked. She ran her hands over her shoulders, ribs, hips, and thighs. "Bruised all over," she said. "But you pulled that animal off me before he could do any serious damage." She was not going to feel sorry for herself. He liked that. He said, "When the water's warm, I'll wash away the blood." He kept food in a tin box. He took out a knuckle of ham and dropped it in the saucepan, then added water from the jug. He rinsed a turnip and began to slice it into the pan. He caught Katerina's eye and saw a look of surprise. She said, "Did your father cook?" "No," said Grigori, and in a blink he was transported back to the age of 11. The nightmare memories of Princess Bea could no longer be resisted. He put the pan down heavily on the table, then sat on the edge of the bed and buried his head in his hands, overwhelmed by grief. "No," he repeated, "my father didn't cook." 5. They came to the village at dawn. The local land captain and 6 cavalrymen. As soon as Ma heard the trotting hoofbeat, she picked up Lev. He was a heavy burden at age 6, but Ma was broad-shouldered and strong-armed. She grabbed Grigori's hand and ran out of the house. The horsemen were being led by the village elders, who must have met them at the outskirts. Because there was only one door, Grigori's family had no chance of concealment, and as soon as they appeared, the soldiers spurred their mounts. Ma pounded around the side of the house, scattering chickens and scaring the goat so that it broke its tether and bolted too. She ran across the waste ground at the back toward the trees. They might have escaped, But Grigori suddenly realized that his grandmother was not with them. He stopped and pulled his hand free.
"We forgot Gren," he squealed. "She can't run," Ma yelled back.
Grigori knew that. Gren could hardly walk. But all the same, he felt they must not leave her behind.
"Grishka, come on!"
Ma shouted, and she ran ahead, still carrying Lev, who was now shrieking with fear. Grigori followed, but the delay had been fatal. The horsemen came closer, one approaching on either side. The path to the woods was cut off. In desperation, Ma ran into the pond, but her feet sank into the mud. She slowed down, and at last she fell into the water. The soldiers hooted with laughter. They tied Ma's hands and marched her back.
"Make sure the boys come too," said the land captain. "Prince's orders."
Grigori's father had been taken away a week ago, along with two other men. Yesterday, Prince Andrei's household carpenters had built a scaffold in the north meadow. Now, as Grigori followed his mother into the meadow, he saw three men standing on the scaffold, bound hand and foot, with ropes around their necks. Beside the scaffold stood a priest. Ma screamed,
"No!"
She began to struggle with the rope that bound her hands. A cavalryman drew a rifle from the holster fixed to his saddle and, reversing it, hit her in the face with its wooden stock. She stopped struggling and began to sob. Grigori knew what this meant. His father was going to die here. He had seen horse thieves hanged by the village elders, though that had seemed different because the victims were men he did not know. He was seized by a terror that turned his entire body numb and feeble. Perhaps something would happen to prevent the execution. The Tsar might intervene if he truly watched over his people, or perhaps an angel. Grigori's face felt wet and he realized he was crying. He and his mother were forced to stand right in front of the scaffold. The other villagers gathered around. Like Ma, the wives of the other two men had to be dragged there, screaming and crying, their hands bound, their children holding on to their skirts and howling in terror. On the dirt track beyond the field gate stood a closed carriage, its matching chestnut horses cropping the roadside grass. When everyone was present, a black-bearded figure emerged from the carriage in a long dark coat. Prince Andrei. He turned and gave his hand to his little sister, Princess Bea, with furs around her shoulders against the morning cold. The princess was beautiful, Grigori could not help noticing, with pale skin and fair hair, just as he imagined angels to look, even though she was obviously a devil. The prince addressed the villagers.
"This meadow belongs to Princess Bea," he said. "No one may graze cattle here without her permission. To do so is to steal the princess's grass."
There was a murmur of resentment from the crowd. They did not believe in this kind of ownership, despite what they were told every Sunday in church. They adhered to an older peasant morality, according to which the land was for those who worked it. The prince pointed to the three men on the scaffold.
"These fools broke the law, not once, but repeatedly."
His voice was shrill with outrage, like a child whose toy has been snatched.
"Worse, they told others that the princess had no right to stop them, and that fields the landowner is not using should be available to poor peasants."
Grigori had heard his father say such things often.
"As a result, men from other villages have started grazing cattle on land that belongs to the nobility. Instead of repenting their sins, these three have turned their neighbors into sinners too. That is why they have been sentenced to death."
He nodded to the priest. The priest climbed the makeshift steps and spoke quietly to each man in turn. The first nodded expressionlessly. The second wept and began to pray aloud. The third, Grigori's father, spat in the priest's face. No one was shocked. The villagers had a low opinion of the clergy, and Grigori had heard his father say that they told the police everything they heard in the confessional. The priest descended the steps, and Prince Andrei nodded to one of his servants who was standing by with a sledgehammer. Grigori noticed for the first time that the three condemned men were standing on a crudely hinged wooden platform, supported only by a single prop, and he realized with terror that the sledgehammer was to knock away the prop. Now, he thought, this is when an angel should appear. The villagers moaned. The wives began to scream, and this time the soldiers did not stop them. Little Lev was hysterical. He probably did not understand what was about to happen, Grigori thought. but he was scared by their mother's shrieks. Pa showed no emotion. His face was stony. He looked into the distance and awaited his fate. Grigori wanted to be that strong. He struggled to maintain his self-control, even though he needed to howl like Lev. He could not hold back the tears, but he bit his lip and remained as silent as his father. The servant hefted his sledgehammer, touched it to the prop to get his range, swung backward and struck. The prop flew through the air. The hinged platform came down with a bang. The three men dropped, then jerked, their fall arrested by the ropes around their necks. Grigori was unable to look away. He stared at his father. Pa did not die instantly. He opened his mouth, trying to breathe or to shout, but could not do either. His face turned red and he struggled with the ropes that bound him. It seemed to go on for a long time. His face became redder. Then his skin turned a bluish color and his movements became weaker. At last he was still. Mother stopped screaming and began to sob. The priest prayed aloud, but the villagers ignored him and, one by one, they turned away from the sight of the three dead men. The prince and the princess got back into their carriage, and after a moment, the coachman cracked his whip and drove away. 6. Grigori was calm again by the time he finished telling the story. He dragged his sleeve across his face to dry his tears, then turned his attention back to Katerina. She had listened to him in compassionate silence, but she was not shocked. She must have seen similar sights herself. Hanging, flogging, and mutilation were normal punishments in the villages. Grigori put the bowl of warm water on the table and found a clean towel. Katerina tilted her head back, and Grigori hung the kerosene lamp from a hook on the wall so that he could see better. There was a cut on her forehead and a bruise on her cheek, and her lips were puffy. Even so, staring at her close up took Grigori's breath away. She looked back at him with a candid, fearless gaze that he found enchanting. He dipped a corner of the towel in warm water. "Be gentle," she said. "Of course." He began by wiping her forehead. Her injury there was only a graze, he saw when he had dabbed away the blood. "That feels better," she said. She watched his face while he worked. He washed her cheeks and her throat, then said, "I've left the painful part until last." "It will be all right," she said. "You have such a light touch." All the same, she winced when his towel touched her swollen lips. "Sorry," he said. "Keep going." The abrasions were already healing, he saw as he cleaned them. She had the even white teeth of a young girl. He wiped the corners of her wide mouth. As he bent closer, he could feel her warm breath on his face. When he had finished, he felt a sense of disappointment, as if he had been waiting for something that had not happened. He sat back and rinsed the towel in the water, which was now dark with her blood. "Thank you," she said. "You have very good hands." His heart was racing. He had bathed people's wounds before, but he had never experienced this dizzy sensation. He felt he might be about to do something foolish. He opened the window and emptied the bowl, making a pink splash on the snow in the yard.